This is The Takeaway for August 31st, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's good to have you with us today. You're hearing there the gospel voices of volunteers at the Lone Star Expo Center. That's a convention center turned emergency shelter in Conroe, Texas. The sun came out over Houston on Wednesday. It was a sure signal that the rains are moving on, but also it shined a light on a new terrible reality. Harvey is moving up the coast and inland, and in South Texas now, a transition all too familiar in disasters. The terror of flooding and rescue subsides, and then the sun breaks through to show you what's ahead, the slow, filthy, and waterlogged grind of recovery. Houston's curfew was lifted at 5 a.m. Some of the city's residents emerged from their homes to assess the damage, and the president made remarks from Missouri on Wednesday afternoon.
Recovery will be tough, but I have seen the resilience of the American spirit firsthand all over this country. To the people of Houston and across Texas and Louisiana, we are here with you today. We are with you tomorrow, and we will be with you every single day after to restore, recover, and rebuild.
Words of reassurance from the president there. Congressman Joaquin Castro is a Democrat who represents San Antonio in the 20th District in Texas. San Antonio has already sheltered thousands of evacuees from the Jefferson County and Houston areas up the road, along with other affected communities in his area. Congressman, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
As I mentioned, San Antonio has opened its doors to neighbors from across the state and across the area affected by this devastating flooding. What's going on around your district? What have you seen as you've gone to some of the places where people are taking shelter?
Well, I had a chance a few days ago to visit two of the shelters who were taking in evacuees. And as you can imagine, it was people that were nervous and anxious about the future. We received mostly people in the early waves coming from Corpus Christi, Rockport, Victoria, and those areas. And San Antonio did the same thing when Hurricane Katrina hit a dozen years ago. And so we're ready to help in any way that we can.
How have the federal authorities been performing in the area, in your estimation so far? How has FEMA been performing in getting people enrolled for housing, signed up for emergency benefits, and things like that?
I think for the most part, the federal, state, and local responses have been well coordinated, but nobody anticipated the scale of this disaster. It, of course, broke the record for the largest landfall, the largest rainfall in American history. And so I think nobody was prepared for the scale. That said, everybody has mobilized very quickly and tried to do everything possible on search and rescue and to get people to safety.
Have you heard any complaints either from your constituents or from members of Congress who represent neighboring districts about what more they need from federal authorities right now?
I think everybody's worked in a cooperative spirit so far and very much in the moment to try to do what's necessary to help people get out of danger. But when we get back to Congress, Texas is going to need a supplemental aid package in the billions and billions of dollars. And I hope that it can be supported in a bipartisan way, that we won't see a lot of the divisive fighting that happened during the debate over the Superstorm Sandy relief package, for example. The Congress also needs to reauthorize the National Flood Insurance Program, which is set to expire on September 30th.
Well, let's talk about an aid package for South Texas and the surrounding area and what the price tag might be. In the end, the federal government spent about $125 billion on Hurricane Katrina along the Gulf Coast. There have been asks already that have suggested that the price tag for Harvey could be even higher. I heard one of your colleagues mention $152 billion, which is astronomical. Are you on board with a figure of that size? What are you hearing?
Well, you know, we won't have an exact calculation for a while, but the scale of this disaster is obviously incredible. And so it won't surprise me if that number is also very high, because Houston is the fourth largest city in the country, but it's also affected in that coastal Bend region. And now what's known as the Golden Triangle in Texas, the Beaumont and Port Arthur area. So it's just pure devastation here in Texas.
You mentioned some of the divisive fights of the past, Superstorm Sandy, congressional fights over funding, how to pay for it. There were members of Congress from your delegation who voted against some of that funding or didn't want to vote for it unless money was taken from elsewhere. I know you want to avoid that now, but if it's happened in the very recent past, why wouldn't the same thing happen now?
No, you're right. Both Texas Senators, Cornyn and Cruz, and many of the Texas Republicans voted against the Superstorm Sandy relief. But there were also many Texans in Congress, myself included, who voted for it and were supportive throughout. And as Peter King, a Republican from New York, said, you know, one bad turn doesn't deserve another. And so I'm hoping that we can get very clear and strong support across the country and across party lines for the people of Texas.
Have you gotten any guarantees across those party lines, not only in your delegation, but from the White House or congressional leaders that they want to avoid a fight like that?
No, you know, we've not started that conversation yet, but I do think that it was encouraging that the president declared Texas a disaster area right away, that he worked with the governor and the Texas members of Congress to do that. So I think that's a great start.
Congressman Joaquin Castro represents the 20th District in Texas. He's a Democrat from San Antonio. Congressman, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
A disaster of Harvey's scale destroys buildings and homes and factories, and it also destroys routine. Something as normal as back-to-school time is now remote for students in Houston. Public school classes were supposed to open last Monday, but with so much damage to campuses and homes, no one knows exactly when classes can start. Suzanne Renslaben is the executive director for the Aransas County ISD Education Foundation, here to tell us what it will take to get Houston area schools up and running again. Suzanne, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Well, Houston is north of me. We were actually in Rockport, which is where the eye of the storm came in. And when it hit us with 130 plus miles an hour winds, it virtually destroyed all of our schools and a lot of the houses. I spoke to our superintendent yesterday, and after the analysis has been done, it will probably be January before our kids even have a shot at getting back. We're looking at 4 to 6 weeks before we have any electricity. And for our kids, that's devastating because over 60% of our kids come from low-income families. Some of them now don't have homes at all. And they count on our schools for their breakfasts, their lunches, for the security and the routine that they aren't going to have right now. They're going to have to be going to area schools that were not hit like ours were. But nobody can even get into the schools just yet because of the wires hanging, and we've actually lost full buildings in some places.
Suzanne, how many students are missing school now in your area?
We have 3,000 in our school district, 5 different campuses. Actually, we cover the entire county of Aransas, so anyone who lives in Aransas County will have to go outside of the county to find a school to go to until we can actually get our classes together.
You talked about the severe damage to the physical plants, to the actual schools in your county. Talk a little bit more about the damage to routine and the lives of these 3,000 students.
Well, a lot of our students, this is the safest place they have. Some of them who come from severe poverty, they come to school to get some semblance of being normal in their lives, and that will be broken. A lot of them, again, they depend on the food. They depend on having friends and teachers who support them and make them, I guess, have that sense of self-worth that they often don't have at home. And it will be very difficult for them because they're used to that. They count on that. And now they're going to have to go to a different school until ours can reopen. And that puts them in another whole environment that they're not used to, where they don't know anyone, and where they're going to be the outsiders coming in because people are going to know they're not going to be there very long.
If it's going to be January before schools in your county can be up and running, have you heard of a concrete plan now to get Aransas County kids into those other schools? Do you know when that's going to start to happen?
Yes, parents were notified yesterday that that needs to begin immediately. The area schools are aware of it, but to have 3,000 students displaced, it's going to be very difficult on these other districts to accommodate all of that, to find a place for everyone.
Meanwhile, Suzanne Rensleben, you've started a crowdsourcing effort not only to raise money for these disruptions, but to get school supplies, other supplies for a lot of these displaced students. Talk about that.
Well, a lot of our buildings that were destroyed, either they were completely taken out or they have no roofs on them, no walls on them. So a lot of the supplies that we have, the computers, the iPads, the Chromebooks that the teachers count on to use in the classroom, we will have to replace all of that. And our district, I know a lot of people may say, well, you know, you're going to have insurance. Well, that may be true, but when you have a $3 million deductible, that's really hard to make up. So we're trying to help bridge that gap that our district is going to be facing just to come back to normal.
Suzanne, many of the students, as you mentioned, are going to be going to neighboring schools. What about students displaced entirely? What about teachers displaced entirely? I have to imagine that many, many people who would attend classes or work in your county have gone elsewhere.
They're not going to move away. This is their home. We're a very resilient community and we help each other. Our teachers have been assured that they will be paid so that their lives don't have to be disrupted financially in addition to what they're already facing. They will be helping as soon as the campuses are available, and everybody will come together as a team and try to put it back together. People in our neighboring counties are helpful too. There's people from all over the United States in our area right now just trying to get the electricity back up, to get the telephone lines working. It's just such a monumental job with so many of the lines down and in water that it's going to take an inordinate amount of time. We don't know how fast they're going to be able to get that done.
Suzanne, we've been talking about the students in the buildings, and you're responsible for the Education Foundation there and for worrying about all this stuff. You're also a resident in the county with a home, I'm sure. What about
Yes.
you? How's your house? How's your family? And how are your friends?
My house is okay. It doesn't have as much damage as others. I know our CFO lost her house entirely. We have a lot of people who live in mobile homes, and they are scattered all over South Texas. They've lost everything. Everybody is in the process of just trying to pick up the pieces and making it watertight for now until we can start rebuilding.
Suzanne Rensleben, we wish you the best. Thank you for spending this time with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Suzanne Rensleben is the executive director for the Aransas County ISD Education Foundation. There were some new developments this week on President Trump's ordered ban on transgender service members in the military. Defense Secretary James Mattis announced on Tuesday that he's freezing that ban. Now, some media outlets took that as a sign of a rift between Mattis and the commander-in-chief on the transgender policy. But in fact, Mattis was only announcing that he's maintaining the status quo in the military while the Pentagon moves on to study how to implement the president's order to block transgender people from serving. Sean Snow is a reporter for the Military Times and a Marine Corps veteran here to help us understand what's going on between the Pentagon and the White House. Good to have you back, Sean.
Thanks for having me on, Todd.
Sean, there's been a lot of speculation about what the order would mean because the president's initial statements on this ban were on Twitter and they were so brief. There have been a couple of ping pong back and forth now between the Pentagon and the White House. What do we know about what the White House policy is right now, for instance, on whether transgender people currently serving would be allowed to stay in the military?
Well, we basically, and I think you correctly pointed out that some outlets are kind of describing this as a rift between Mattis and Trump. But Mattis is really just implementing what the president outlined in his memo, which requires that a study be completed and submitted by February 21st, and by March 23rd of 2018 that the president's memorandum would take effect, which would ban transgender service members from coming into the military. And the memorandum basically leads up to Mattis and this study to figure out what to do with currently serving transgendered service members. But it's not really a rift. It's just Mattis implementing what was already outlined in the memo that was put forth by the White House.
And what does the memo actually say about what should be studied, what should be considered here as Mattis and the civilian brass at the Pentagon? Well, there's no such thing as civilian brass, but the civilian leadership at the Pentagon think about how to move forward here.
Well, the memo definitely says that in the memo, in Trump's formal memo, it says that it shall determine how to address transgender individuals already serving in the military. Section 2B calls for a halt of funds for sex reassignment surgery. But Section 2A of the memo leads open that if Mattis and his study finds evidence contrary to what the president's current position already is, that they could potentially reverse course. And it says, provides a recommendation to the contrary that I find convincing, Section 2A of the memo.
So that's called wiggle room, right? That's called daylight. That means if this Pentagon study finds that the cost is low, or that group cohesion isn't affected, or that transgender people are as lethal as everybody else in a war, that they could reverse course?
Yeah, absolutely. It sounds like that leaves a little bit of wiggle room for Mattis and the Department of Homeland Security to provide their advice to the president, and that could be wiggle room for them to reverse course on this. But here's another problem that we already have a study that was done. There was a RAND study done last year in 2016. That's when the Obama administration reversed course to allow transgender service members to serve openly. And we already have a lot of data from that. So there's some questions about why a new study even needs to be done. For instance, the RAND study already found that several thousand active duty and reserve members are currently serving in the military as transgender. And only a few hundred of those individuals would undertake gender reassignment surgery. And this issue comes down to deployability and unit cohesion, according to Mattis and the Pentagon. This study found that this would only cost about $2.4 to $8.4 million. It's only 0.005% to 0.01% of DOT healthcare expenditures, and only 0.0015% would not be able to deploy. So the study already looked at unit cohesion and already looked at the deployability factors and found it to not have a great effect on military readiness. And for example, they cite that in 2015 alone, 50,000 Army service members couldn't deploy for various reasons, whether legal, medical, or dental. So it found that there was no unit cohesion issues or deployability issues in the military as a result of lifting the transgender service ban or allowing them to serve openly. And on top of that, there's 18 countries that had already allowed transgender service members to serve openly: Australia, Canada, Germany, Israel, the United Kingdom. And none of them have reported negative impacts of operational readiness or unit cohesion as a result of this. So we already have a study. So I guess there's a question as to why there's a need for another study.
Right. Well, if the RAND study has already been done and it's so comprehensive, Sean, you've been in Washington for a while, I know. That's one of the things maybe that leads people to suggest a rift. Not that Mattis is going against the commander in chief, but if the study is out there, we all know that ordering a study in the Pentagon and in Washington is a delay tactic a lot of times. And people have speculated that this could have been the president out on a policy limb tweeting about transgender people, and that this is Mattis's way of reeling him back in and letting this marinate for a few months.
Yeah, I believe so. But I think Mattis had also been calling for a new study to be done when he came in. I believe it was in February he called for a study, and he put a temporary halt to transgender service members, new transgender service members coming in. This was all before Trump's tweet. So Mattis had already been planning to do a new study. So I think it kind of calls into question whether or not the DOD accepts the findings of the RAND study and what is going to come out of a new study. Mattis's memo outlines that he's going to have talented individuals, and they're going to look at all kinds of data and quantifying elements for the study. But as I've already stated, you know, this has already been done in the RAND survey. And, you know, we're coming with some issues, too. Right now, the Pentagon is not fully staffed. There's a lot of senior personnel not currently in positions where they need to be. So this new study that's supposed to come out is not even hitting the ground running right now.
Well, right before we let you go, Sean, here, there's obviously a lot of nervous service members in the military now. Do you have a sense of whether Mattis would come down on the side of ejecting transgender people from the military?
I don't really know what Mattis's position is on the issue per se, but I do think that people should, you know, kind of take a step back and putting Mattis in the limelight of some LGBT hero here. We'll have to wait to see what comes out of the study, but it seems kind of strange that we're having a new study when this has already been debated and has already been hashed out.
Sean Snow, reporter with the Military Times and a Marine Corps vet. Thanks, Sean.
Thank you.
Republicans in Congress are making a huge push now to try to get the first major tax reform in 30 years. President Trump gave his first major speech on tax policy during a visit to Springfield, Missouri yesterday.
We need a tax code that is simple, fair, and easy to understand. That means getting rid of the loopholes and complexity that primarily benefit the wealthiest Americans and special interests.
Now, that speech was pretty light on specifics, but the president did try to make the case that cutting taxes for corporations and small businesses is what's best for the workers who voted him into office in this populist election. Still, tax reform is now the top priority for congressional Republicans because without an Obamacare repeal to show to voters, they're in danger of ending the GOP president's first year in office with no major legislative accomplishments to show for it. Richard Rubin is here with all the details. He's U.S. tax policy reporter for The Wall Street Journal in Washington. Hi, Richard.
Hey, how are you?
I'm well, thanks. I just said you're here with the details, but is that true? Are there any details for this plan yet?
No, I'm here with the sketch, the broad brush.
Right. Look,
this was a first attempt by the president to get himself engaged in trying to sell tax reform, tax cuts, tax something to the public. And that's something Republicans have been really looking for a long time on the Hill. They want to write the bill. They want to figure out the details and make the numbers work and figure out where the votes come from. And the role of the president in part here is to work with him on that, but also to sell to the public, to really go out there and make the case for what should happen. And this first speech was really about the why, you know, both according to what you heard from the president and from White House officials, that they say that this is about what the problems are in the tax code. It's too complicated. It's not fair. It hurts the economy. All of those things you heard in that little clip. And then we'll get to the how a little bit later.
Still, in this sketch that you're drawing, Richard Rubin, we do know at least some of the hues, right? I mean, the president is billing this with his populist message that's so familiar, a boon for workers, better and more jobs. But isn't the overall plan heavily weighted on tax cuts for wealthy investors and a huge tax cut for corporations?
So we don't know exactly where they're heading, but we know roughly where they're heading. And look at the things that the president has been consistent on. He's been consistent on the tax rate on corporations should be lower. The tax rate on other kinds of businesses should be lower. The bulk of those things really do benefit shareholders, high-income households. There are some things that directly benefit middle-income households, doubling the standard deduction, for example. But, you know, tax bills get messy because of the details. So what are those loopholes that might go away? You know, one man's loophole is another man's job.
Meanwhile, behind the scenes, I guess, on Capitol Hill, this army of lobbyists is going to descend, or already has, because every loophole is millions of dollars to defend for one interest or another. But how important is it for Paul Ryan and congressional Republicans to get this done?
Oh, it's hugely politically important. I mean, they've been talking about this for years. As you noted, the failure on health care, at least so far, means they don't have something big legislatively to show to voters when they go into the midterms next year. The time clock here is ticking, and so they're really trying to get this done either toward the end of this year or the really early part of 2018. And look, the tax code is there, not like it didn't descend from someplace mysterious. It was there because previous Congresses put it there. Previous Congresses were elected by voters and responding to the cacophony of interest groups that are out there. So undoing that is just as hard as doing it in the first place.
Congress is on its way back for its fall session, and the huge job of tax reform is right ahead of them. Richard Rubin with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Richard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, Congress may or may not cut your taxes, but Whole Foods and their new bosses at Amazon are going to try to cut your grocery bill. Amazon officially took control over Whole Foods on Monday after paying a cool $13 billion for it back in June. For a coming out this week, Amazon cut prices in some locations of the country's biggest premium grocer by up to 43%. Joining me to discuss what this means both for the grocery stores and for consumers who shop there, Britton Ladd, a strategy consultant who worked at Amazon between 2015 and 2017 on international retail and grocery operations. Britton, thanks for being here.
You're welcome. Nice to speak with you.
What's behind Amazon's decision not only to buy Whole Foods in the first place in June, but then to turn around and drop prices like they did this week?
Primarily, the reason why Amazon acquired Whole Foods is that there is a very large segment of customers who want to inspect and select the product they buy, especially as it relates to fruits, vegetables, meat, eggs, so forth. And Amazon knew that in order to gain the most market share, to be able to delight the most customers, they needed a physical retail presence, and Whole Foods fit their needs perfectly. The reason why they cut food prices is that Amazon really has to be able to send a strong signal to customers that the whole era of whole paycheck is now gone. And they also wanted to send a very strong message to their competitors that Amazon isn't afraid of a price war and that Amazon is in this thing to win it.
So in terms of food retail, then, dropping prices at Whole Foods, is this Amazon, you know, exchanging margin on items, less money they get per item in exchange for bringing in a broader range of customers into the store?
Correct. And here's the thing to remember. Amazon isn't concerned about margin. Amazon is not concerned whether they make any money on their groceries in the beginning. And the reason is because they are not wanting to be a grocery retailer. They are wanting to reimagine the grocery experience. The only way that they can collect the data they need to be able to learn what consumers want is to get as many of those consumers to now start turning to Whole Foods. And it's through that process that you'll see Amazon tweak the methodology going forward, tweak the stores going forward. But what Amazon is really needing to do at this stage is get data, gain understanding, and if they have to sacrifice margin for that, that's just simply not a concern for them.
So a massive retail and social experiment going on behind the scenes as we shop for our food at Whole Foods, which will be a little bit cheaper now. You actually recommended back in 2012, and you were at Amazon, that they do this, that they buy Whole Foods. Why did that seem like a good move at the time?
Well, it's interesting. I actually wrote a paper in 2012 called A Beautiful Way to Save Woolworths, where in the paper I argued that Amazon was actually a very weak retailer when it came to groceries because of their online model. And I did two things. I designed a store for Amazon, and then I made a recommendation they acquire Whole Foods. But I actually did that while I was working as a consultant for Deloitte. I wasn't working for Amazon at the time. So when I joined Amazon, I began to speak openly about the importance of Amazon looking at making an acquisition, going much deeper into physical retail. But in 2012, it was clear to me, and just as it's clear to me today, Amazon will never be a major player in groceries without a very strong physical retail presence. And that's one of the major reasons why Amazon acquired Whole Foods. They understand that very well.
So, Britton, we have to let you go, but just a quick word on what could go wrong here. Consumers like better prices, no problem there. What's the downside?
Well, the downside is that no matter what Amazon does, it doesn't move the needle. And I've been very vocal in stating that if Amazon isn't careful, Whole Foods could turn out to be their bridge too far. I don't anticipate that happening, but Amazon absolutely can run into trouble. Let's not forget, Whole Foods was a failing retailer when Amazon acquired them, and that won't change overnight simply because Amazon is now the owner.
You go shopping at Whole Foods, and it's not about the groceries that you acquire. Amazon is watching you. They want to know what you buy and why. Britton Ladd, strategy consultant, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Early this morning, the city of Beaumont, Texas, lost access to its water supply as a result of Harvey. Waters from a nearby river flooded the city's pumping station, and it could take several days to get the system back up and running. Meanwhile, in Houston, the flooding has made delivery of food and water to local stores impossible in some areas. Long lines, very limited inventory, and some reports of price gouging have many Houstonians worried.
Our neighborhood isn't prone to flooding. But my family, unfortunately, they live further into the Fort Bend County, and they were told to evacuate. So we took them in into our home for a total of 13. So we were concerned about, you know, having enough food for everyone in case, especially in case power ran out.
That's Jean Caneda. She's a Houston resident from the Crestwater Trail neighborhood southwest of downtown Houston.
Yesterday morning, the rain stopped, and we found out that the Kroger, which is a grocery store right next to us, we're going to open for a limited amount of time. So we got to the Kroger, and to our surprise, there was already a long line. We waited it out. We knew it'd be at least a 3-hour wait. What about us? Will we have enough to choose from when it was our turn? So we came out with a bunch of canned items, Spam, Vienna sausage. We were already stocked on instant noodles. At this point, you know, you can't really be picky. You just grab what won't spoil and what will sustain you.
Residents in Houston lining up and grabbing what they can in the aftermath of the storm. Catherine Blunt is a business reporter with the Houston Chronicle, and she's been reporting on the ground as lines form outside of grocery stores and reporting on the monumental task of restocking those stores as Houston recovers. Catherine, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you for having me.
You have been down to many of these grocery stores and seen the lines. What's the situation?
Well, you know, particularly earlier in the week, lines were absolutely out the door as companies were able to bring stores back online. Stock is still very low in many locations. There are huge swaths of roadway still underwater, making it very difficult for their trucks to get in and restock at the rate needed to keep up with the extreme demand after the storm just completely inundated this region.
How many stores were closed around the region, if you even have a number? And what is the difficulty in getting restocked logistically?
I don't have an exact number of the number of stores closed around the region, but in the midst of the storm, most major chains had closed most stores. However, they were successful at getting those stores opened very, very quickly in the aftermath. They were working around the clock, and now we have hundreds of grocery stores that have opened. That being said, so many are running on inventory still. A couple of major chains, H-E-B, Kroger, have had difficulties getting their trucks across, you know, the highways. There's still big, large parts of the highways that are still flooded out. And also roads in the outlying parts of the county, those are flooded too. Parts of the city are still underwater. Closer to the downtown area, things are drying up. You can get around with relative ease, but that is certainly not the case throughout the entirety of the county at this point, which is has restricted their access to certain locations to a great degree.
And in terms of the stock that's available, Catherine, is fresh fruit and produce available, or are we talking primarily water, canned food, dry goods?
Sure. In certain locations, those things have become available. In other locations, things like eggs, milk, and bread, those are still limited. Water is flying off the shelves at and a very fast rate, as you can imagine. Retailers are having difficulty keeping that stocked. And, you know, in certain locations, yeah, I think that fresh food is going to be really difficult to get there, especially those stores that are just running on inventory at this point. It's going to be, you're absolutely going to find more packaged goods than anything else.
I want to ask you about price gouging. It's always a risk after disasters like this. And we saw some after Hurricane Katrina and other flooding episodes across the South. There was a viral image on social media yesterday of a Best Buy in the area selling overpriced water. Was that an isolated incident? Are you hearing about gouging in other places?
We're hearing about gouging in other places. I don't believe you're going to find that to any great degree at the major retailers. I think that was an honest mistake by an employee, that viral image. But it's certainly something that we're keeping an eye on. That is illegal. As you said, after any major disaster, it is a risk. and something that we're monitoring.
If price gouging is unlikely to be a problem at big corporate retail stores, where might it be a problem? Smaller stores or privately owned businesses?
Sure. And certainly not to generalize, but I think that if there was an opportunity to do so, you might find that with a bit more frequency in a smaller operation.
So what are retailers saying then about the medium term and long term recovery of their stores and their supply chains to at least get the food retail situation someplace back to normal during recovery here?
Sure. I've been very impressed by the round-the-clock efforts that they have been putting forth in these past few days, because the results have really been astounding, the number of stores that are up and running again. That being said, talking to certain executives, I've really never heard such frankness in their assessment of the situation, saying, you know, it's not going to be days, it's not going to be weeks, but it's going to be months before we might get back to relative normality here. Because, like I said, I mean, there are parts of the city that are still underwater. And in terms of being able to navigate that on a consistent basis and get a consistent flow of goods into areas that have been totally inundated, I'm not sure if anyone has a great sense of when that can be done on the day-to-day, round-the-clock basis that they're used to operating on in order to keep everything flowing as it should. So I think that it remains to be seen in the coming days to what degree the flooding threat continues. It is certainly still continuing. And I can tell you, though, that no one's sleeping on the part of the big retailers. They're trying their absolute best, and so far have been, I think, as successful as they possibly could be.
Houston and the surrounding area now hard at work on recovery, and that includes food retailers with lines out the door and across the parking lot in many locations as residents move to try to restock after severe flooding. Catherine Blunt with the Houston Chronicle, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. There's been a lot of focus this week on the immediate damage created by Hurricane Harvey in Texas. But as we've been hearing today on the show, the focus is now slowly shifting to Houston's recovery. And here's one very alarming figure that's likely to factor into that recovery. Only an estimated 2 out of every 10 homeowners in Houston have flood insurance. Carolyn Kuski is Director of Policy Research and Engagement at the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Carolyn, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me on today.
Thanks for being here. That figure of 2 in 10 Houston homeowners who have flood insurance, it's surprisingly low. Or is it? Why do so few people have it?
It is low, and it's surprisingly low in Houston given the flood risk, but it's low nationwide. Very few people end up having flood coverage. There's a number of reasons for that. Sometimes people don't realize that their standard homeowner's policy excludes floods, and in order to be covered against flood damages, you have to have a separate policy from the National Flood Insurance Program.
So the only flood insurance that's available to most homeowners if they want it is through this federal program? How does it work?
That's right. There's a very small private market, but for the most part, you have to get it through the NFIP. The program was set up back in 1968, largely in response to the fact that there was little availability of flood coverage from the private sector. It was designed as a partnership between the federal government and communities. So communities voluntarily join the program. When they do that, they have to adopt some minimum floodplain management regulations. And then in exchange, all their residents are eligible to purchase flood insurance through the program.
So if you live in the federally drawn flood zone, right, then you have to have the insurance. The insurance is subsidized through the federal government. That's sort of the idea here. What does the flood zone look like? How do they draw it?
Yeah, FEMA produces flood maps that show flood hazard for communities. And the most important feature of those maps is the 100-year floodplain, which is sometimes referred to as the special flood hazard area. And if you are mapped inside that area and you have a mortgage from a federally backed or regulated lender, you are required to have flood insurance. And yet we still see, so for example, estimates from FEMA are that in Harris County, only about 30% of households in that special flood hazard area have flood insurance despite this requirement. And it could be because they don't have a qualifying mortgage, and so they're actually not required to, or it could be because they've dropped their policy and they're out of compliance with this regulation.
So you can build in the flood zone with sort of the official government warning behind it that, like, hey, you live in a flood-prone area, but you don't have to have the insurance that the government provides in this case, and that just leaves you exposed.
Yeah, and outside of the special flood hazard area, we see very low take-up of flood insurance. And as we're seeing in Houston right now, flooding is not restricted to this mapped area. It occurs beyond it repeatedly because you have events that are larger than a 100-year event, or also because the maps often fail to show areas of stormwater flooding. So when you have a very intense downpour and it overwhelms local drainage, that type of flooding is not usually depicted on maps. And so there's lots of people who might be at flood risk and have had no idea they were at flood risk.
And so, Carolyn, even inside the federally mandated flood zone where the subsidized federal flood insurance works, we've even seen figures drop, as you mentioned, in recent years. In Houston, the number of homes with the flood insurance is down 9% from 5 years ago. In nearby areas, I saw a figure that said it's down 20%. People are dropping coverage.
People are, and this is true if you look nationwide. The number of policies in force has been declining over recent years, and there's a little bit of puzzlement over what that is. One factor that's probably playing a role here is price. So in 2012 and 2014, Congress passed some reform legislation to phase out some discounts that had been given to roughly 20% of policyholders. And these discounted rates that were given to people who had built before FEMA came in and mapped the area, as they're being phased out, those property owners are facing higher and higher rates, and that might be responsible for some people choosing to drop their flood insurance because it's just getting too expensive for them. But all the underlying factors are a little bit unknown.
So let's talk about then the economic impact here, Carolyn, with all of the exposure that you're talking about, right? With such a low percentage of homes in the flood zone and outside of the flood zone that are covered, that means thousands, hundreds of thousands of homeowners completely exposed to the cost of recovery without insurance. How does the risk adjuster or the economist or the recovery expert look at the overwhelming cost of that and how people pay to get their lives back on track?
Yeah, it's going to be a real struggle for a lot of homeowners in Houston and other areas that have been flooded. Insurance is really essential for resilience of households and communities after a disaster in order to have money quickly to rebuild. And lots of studies have shown that you're much more likely to rebuild and rebuild faster if you have insurance. And part of that is because federal disaster aid is actually quite limited and often delayed. It takes a lot longer to get to people sometimes than insurance does. So President Trump authorized a disaster declaration for Texas, and this allows FEMA to begin spending on what's called the individual assistance program. So they'll provide grants to flood victims, but they're capped at a little over $30,000. Historically, the average is only about $5,000. And so they're really only to make your home safe and habitable. They are not to bring you back to pre-disaster condition. So in order to have the funding to bring yourself, you know, to repair your home to what it looked like before it was flooded, you really have to have insurance. The other line of help for victims would be a loan from the Small Business Administration. And even though it's the Small Business Administration, they do give loans to households to help them finance their repairs. And interestingly, a little known part of that program is that you can borrow a little bit more money to build your home back safer and better. So for example, if you wanted to elevate your home a little bit higher out of the floodplain so that next time the waters come, you're less likely to get damaged, you can get a loan for that. But it is a loan. The rate is subsidized, but it does have to be repaid. It's not free money.
And do we have any sense, though, you know, some people qualify for those loans, some people don't. Do we have any sense of how many people are left completely exposed here, like on their own for recovery?
It's hard to know at this point. FEMA's already, I think, processed about 40,000 applications for their individual assistance grant program, and I haven't seen numbers from the SBA yet. But certainly Congress is going to step in with some sort of supplemental legislation, too. So there might be even more aid coming to the victims.
Carolyn Kuski, Director of Policy Research and Engagement at the Wharton Risk Center at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for walking us through it.
Yeah, thank you.
Well, as more news comes in on the damage in Texas, from a distance, figuring out the best way to help can be a real challenge. And we wanted to know, what are you doing to aid the people inundated by Hurricane Harvey?
This is Lori from Plano, Texas, and my apartment complex had a donation drive for the people in the Houston area or down there where the storm is, and I bought a case of Top Ramen and a bunch of socks and some tampons and feminine napkins and donated those to our drive, so hopefully that will be a little comfort to someone.
This is Christine from Marlton, New Jersey. To help support Hurricane Harvey relief efforts, I made a donation through my Discover card. They will match up to $500,000. So I would check to see if other companies are doing the same thing.
This is Tracy Bohm from Wells, and I am going to pray for the people in Houston and everybody in Texas that is affected by this. And I hope that everybody else in America feels encouraged to pray also.
Voices from you, the takeaway listeners, on what you're doing to help victims of Hurricane Harvey in Texas and up and down the Gulf Coast, doing your part to help your fellow Americans. You can find a list of ways that you can get involved. You can visit our Facebook page or our website at thetakeaway.org. We have a helpful guide there for some of the best agencies and charities where you can send your donations and the places that use your money best to help storm victims. In the meantime, we thank you so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by LegalZoom, working to help Americans take control of their families and assets with an estate planning kit, which includes an informational ebook and other resources. More information available at LegalZoom.com/prepare.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.